You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Soupcast, coming to you from ArchaeoSoup Towers. By popular demand, we're taking selected videos from the ArchaeoSoup back catalogue and bringing them to you as convenient podcasts. As the name implies, with ArchaeoSoup, you get a bit of everything thrown into the pot. Archaeology, discussion, humour and debate. You can find out more at archaeosoup.com. So sit back, relax, and enjoy a hearty helping of Archaeo Soup. Hello, and welcome to Media Picks for the month of June. It's a monthly thing again. The month of June, 2021.
June is busting out all over.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in this week, when I am actually, between you and I, I'm actually going on holiday tomorrow somewhere, taking a little break. We figured that we would have a little bit of a treat. I am joined, of course, by the amazing Andy Brockman. Good afternoon, Andy.
Good afternoon. Basking in the glory of England's victory over Germany last night, as a Welshman, I'm sure you are you are celebrating with the rest of the nation.
Oh, yes, yes, undoubtedly. It's not like last night we enjoyed the ability to go to the tip with no traffic on the road. It was glorious. We could just drive, drop off our rubbish, go to the shops. There was no one around. And every now and then we just heard the sort of, ooh, yay! Cut at the end, it was brilliant. So yeah, no, well done, very happy for you. Anyway, oppressor, oh mine, what is your media pick of the month, Andy?
Okay, we've just been having a bit of fun there at the expense of all the sort of petty nationalism and so on that we're all living through at the moment with the Euros. And serious. Okay. I won't dig any further into that hole. But our viewer will be aware that we've been following the alleged so-called war on woke for some time, and particularly since the toppling of the statue of Sir Edward Colston in Bristol last year. My media pick is a BBC documentary, which is called Statue Wars, One Summer in Bristol, which obviously they didn't know they were going to make until the event actually happened. And filming actually picks up about just under a week after the statue was actually toppled from its plinth into the harbour in Bristol by demonstrators who were supporting the Black Lives Matter movement and anti-racism in the wake of the death of George Floyd in the United States. It was probably the most high-profile manifestation of that movement in the UK, and it led to a reaction from government in terms of enforcing its policy of explain and retain on museum bodies, galleries, communities. And in fact, has even led to draft or proposed legislation which will protect statues from being removed without planning permission, and in extreme cases, the permission of the Secretary of State for Culture, which is a pretty heavy-duty political response to what, as I say, is a one-off event. Very, very cleverly, what this programme did was shadow the Mayor of Bristol, Marvin Rees, who's the first black elected mayor of a city in Western Europe, as he and his top team tried to deal with the fallout from the situation in a city which is divided between very rich areas and very poor areas. It has a very diverse community, and some people might have heard of the area of St. Paul's, which is very identified with the black community, or has been in the past. Certainly was. I lived in Bristol in the early 80s, and even then, issues like which came to a head with Colston were current. So Rees and his team were very aware of what was going on in their city on political grounds, but also on social grounds. But also, again, what was very, I think, very clever about this film was that although it didn't take sides on the statue argument, it hardly covered the statue argument at all. What it looked at was how do you deal with a situation like the one that followed the toppling of Colston, mm-hmm. without being even more divisive and try and turn it into a positive for the city. You saw, for example, not just the reaction to Colston, but the reaction to the deliberate damaging of another listed object, the gravestone of an enslaved African called Scipio, who was called Scipio Africanus by his owner, in a Bristol churchyard that happens shortly after Colston was toppled and was allegedly done as a reaction to Colston being toppled. In other words, you take our heritage, we'll get some of yours. Mm. And also the erection of a resin statue of demonstrator Jen Reed, who famously was photographed standing on top of the plinth when Colston was stopped. Mm. And how that was done and how that was actually removed as well because it broke playing rules.
Yeah.
And the so it was about people in a very difficult situation trying to in a very intense pressure cooker situation politically and socially, trying to prevent things becoming worse. And also, I think what was most interesting as well, it looked at the toll on people who were actually dealing with it. So you had, for example, a member of the mayor's office going through the piles of letters that had come in, mm-hmm. and which were roughly, as she described it, equally split between pro the mayor, the statue coming down, anti the statue coming down, and racist abuse and threats to the mayor and the team, including, you know, a letter enclosing a racist gollywog badge.
Right.
Marvin Rees himself is has a white mother and a black father. Mm. So you know, and also it interviewed his program also interviewed his wife and a very telling interview about the what was clearly the pressure on her and their children through this situation, which hadn't been engineered at all by Rees himself. So it was a very human program. It was a very smart program. It managed to make it implicitly was arguing for an intelligent, negotiated middle way that accepted. You know that when people talk about white privilege, you also need to talk about, for example, deprivation of the white working class, and it's something you'll be familiar with in the Northeast.
You have working class people down south as well. Isn't
it? We do. You know, I live in Woolwich, which is one of the most diverse and poorer areas of London, and just across the river is the London Borough of Newham, which again has the an incredibly diverse population and still areas of power, you know, strong deprivation.
Yeah, but no, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. Former coal mine villages and.
Absolutely, former steel.
Yes.
Absolutely, post-industrial. You know, communities that are on the edge of, you know, disintegration if certain factories close, for example. You know.
So, from what you've described there, I suppose the one thing I find a little bit puzzling, in so much as the rest sounds like something that one would have to watch to. You know, to go with the narrative, but I didn't hear about the Scipio Africanus graveyard attack or gravestone attack. But what I find curious about that is this notion that there's some sort of parity there, because I've never really thought of the statue of Colston as being representative of a group of people. You know, he's first and foremost he's a class of person, I think, and then he's a class of person whose effect on other people was notable, and also notorious, you know, in equal measure. Mm. But the idea that that a statue to a merchant essentially is the equivalent of someone's personal gravestone, I find that an odd one. But then again, I don't know, how deeply are you thinking about things if you're attacking a gravestone for those reasons? I suppose you're not necessarily thinking about things all that deeply. So you say it was clever. Do you think, what's the overall tone? I mean, what should people expect to where should they expect to be mentally when they sort of finish watching it?
I think what you're left thinking is actually, this is blooming difficult. This whole issue is because there are things to be argued on both sides, not in favor of Colston. Colston was a slaver. Colston made his money out of exploiting the black African people who were ripped from their homes and taken across the Atlantic, many of whom died in the process or died quite quickly and quite horribly when they reached the Caribbean. You know, what he did in modern terms is absolutely disgusting. And it is a part of our heritage that, and as the program was saying, you know, that is interesting that the former head girl of a school that was named after Colston appeared in the program. And she said, you can't, not condoning what he did, but we have to come to an understanding of all of this past. You can't just write it out. You can't just delete it. You have to negotiate your way out of it as a community, as a complex community. And I think that was the underlying message of the program, that everybody should, has a voice in this. The proper the best way forward for us as a society is to have an inclusive conversation. There was a very telling moment, for example, when a demonstration took place outside the mayor's office in Town Hall in Bristol, City Hall in Bristol, where it was a primarily a left-wing BLM styled meeting, which tied in with also one of the more left-leaning members of the City Council, who argued that Rees hadn't gone far enough and should be apologising for Bristol's role in the slave industry, the slave trade in the 17th and 18th century. Again, Rees made an argument which, again, I've heard elsewhere, but I think has a lot of merit to it, which is that, yeah, this stuff matters, but it shouldn't be a distraction from the real efforts, which are about dealing with poverty as it affects everybody, which are about dealing with lack of opportunity as it affects everybody. And that's what he can, as mayor, have an impact on. Now, whether he does or not, of course, his constituents will make a judgment on. In fact, he's just been re-elected for another term. But basically, it's complex stuff. If we negotiate our way out of it, we might end up in a better place as society. Of course, if people use the issue for their individual political aims, then we end up with probably more conflict, and it's arguable whether that's actually of any use to anybody.
I suppose a couple of things come to mind on that. And again, I haven't watched it yet, but I do know about the issues surrounding the events in Bristol. And to my mind, and as far as I can tell through observation, no one who topples statues or has toppled this statue, one statue in this country has been toppled. It
Absolutely,
should be reiterated, one. You wouldn't think so, but one has. And as far as I can tell, the goal of that wasn't to delete history. It's not to deny that Colston existed, or proposing the renaming of a school isn't to deny that this was something that happened in and to and for, as it were, the benefit of some people in Britain and Bristol. But rather, it's to make choices as to who it is that we put on plinths and who it is we venerate in the naming of public buildings. There's a difference there. The former head girl of a school saying we shouldn't be deleting history. I don't think that's the goal of anyone who is doing this. Deleting history is, ironically enough, seems to be the thing that people who are very conservative want to have happen, in so much as they want the statue in place, ironically enough, so they don't have to think about the history. It's complicated, isn't it? But this term deletion or deleting or rewriting history, I think is a distraction. I don't think I've actually heard anyone who wants to rewrite history.
No, look,
adding to it, adding extra facts that are uncomfortable, perhaps. But
Yeah. I mean, and she was saying, you know, we need to deal with racism. Mm. You know, we as a society need to deal with racism. So it wasn't a denial or anything like that. Mm. I think. Yeah, you know, as I said, it wasn't primarily about the detailed arguments pro and against Colston, whatever. It was about how you deal, how the people in charge in Bristol, Marvin Rees and his team, dealt with the situation and tried to deal pragmatically and even handedly with the situation when they were under great personal pressure. Mm. You know, someone daubed Rees must die outside their house, the family house. You know, that because politicians have to publish their home addresses in election literature. So it was a situation that came out of a very particular set of circumstances without very much warning. People were trying to deal with it in all its complexities on the hoof. You know,
And in that sense, the second thing I was going to say was that it's interesting how, as you say, the need to tackle current issues of poverty, for example, probably is something that should come first, in so much as if you this goes for some people in my own family, so I can say this with some element of authority. If you are poor, or if you feel as though you are missing out compared to some people you see down the road who appear to be wealthier than you, then you either you know, try and get a better job or whatever, you know, try and improve your circumstances. Or sometimes you can fall back on this notion of, well, what am I rich in then? What about me makes me special? And if someone's whispering in your ear, well, actually, your skin color makes you superior, then you're going to understandably maybe gravitate towards that. I'm not saying it's inevitable, but it does happen. And so if you want to stop people from daubing so-and-so must die on people's doors, maybe you need to examine the circumstances that's led that person to believe that is legitimate political activity.
Absolutely, that's exactly, you know, in the end, you don't watch this program expecting answers to the statues debate, to the culture war. That's not what it says. In fact, the government's barely mentioned. It's about the response of Rees's administration in Bristol to the situation, and then say trying to deal with it on behalf of the whole of the city, not just one part of it, and not just one part of it. Because, you know, like it or not, and disagree with it or not, there are many shades of opinion in this. So any solution is bound to be difficult. Any pragmatic solution is bound to be difficult. It's bound to disappoint some, possibly most. You know, but that's real politique for you. That's what we ask our politicians to do.
So I'm only smiling because that's one of your favourite phrases at the moment.
I'll end with two things, really. It's two short things. First of all, it's to give credit to the director of the programme, Francis Welch, and also to mention that the executive producer, one of the three executive producers, is David Olusoga, who is also a Bristolian. So again, there was buy-in it was very much a locally themed programme talking about a national canvas.
Right.
And I think very valuable for that, because we do tend to speak a lot from a London-centric point of view when it comes to cultural issues, very much often.
Certainly central broadcasters do. Absolutely.
So, you know, this was very much a program with buy-in from Bristol about Bristol, and but with lessons for us all. And I'll finish really with I was reminded earlier on in the week listening. It was actually talking about the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party, but it was an old joke from the days of the Soviet Union, I think it was, which is that the future is certain; it's the past that's questionable.
Yeah. the future is bright, comrade, but the past, well,
exactly.
Well, we can airbrush photos. Yeah, no, yeah, interesting.
Exactly.
Okay, well, my media pick this month is relatively brief. It's one that came out completely out of the blue, and this is the reason why I'm mentioning it. There were a couple of other things that I've been watching that I thought could be interesting, but actually this is, I'm just going to mention this because I'm genuinely surprised by it, and that is a computer game called Uncharted Golden Abyss on the PlayStation Vita. Now, the Vita is a 10-year-old game system. Yeah,
right.
It was released, I think, in 2011-ish. And Golden Abyss was a launch game for that system. And it's an interesting little handheld console that has some certain key features which have led to a very engaging bit of computer gaming that has some interesting archaeological bits in it. So the rest of the Uncharted series is very Clive Cussler. It's very kind of...
Dirk Pitt raised the Titanic stuff.
Yeah, that kind of thing. You know, so there's an ancient city, a lost city that's discovered. There's a... the only thing that's really missing is the gratuitous inclusion of a vintage vehicle of some sort of a car for Dirk to sorry... for Nathan Drake to notice, but it's a really good series. It's been fun. I was first introduced to it during the lockdowns when the trilogy, the first three games, were made free on the PlayStation Network. Because the PS4 was my first PlayStation. And then, hence, having been a Nintendo boy all my life, as it were, I'd never got a PS Vita or some sort of or a handheld PlayStation console. So when a friend of mine said, "I can sell you this for a very attractive price," I took him up on it and gave it a go. And I suppose what I want to talk about is the fact that it's very intuitive. In terms of the use of things like touch screens, and there's a touch screen on the screen is touchable, but also on the back there's a touch pad, so you can do things like climb a rope by sort of sliding your fingers down the back of the console, so it's as though you're climbing a rope. It's little things like that. It's kind of cute, but actually there's some really interesting little nods to actual archaeologists. So in this series, where for the most part, really, archaeologists are actually just treasure hunters. In this instance, the whole game starts out with an excavation and a discovery of Mesoamerican ruins, having halted the construction of a road in Colombia, I believe. And there's an actual archaeological dig. We go to an archaeological dig. We get to pick up a skull and rotate it round using the touchscreen on the back of the controller. You can clean artifacts. So, like at one point, there's a conquistador helmet that you're sort of rotating and then dusting off the dust from with your finger. You can do charcoal rubbings of you know, bas relief on carved stone, and also so far again I haven't finished the game yet, but you can do things like putting together torn up documents to reconstruct an ancient title deed or something.
Do you get to take down the bas relief and smuggle it out of the country and then sell it in a London auction house?
No, you don't. But that, you see, this is the thing. This is why I'm being very specific about this, is that Uncharted has, for me, because I'm not the first archaeologist that I know. Can I talk about myself in the third person like that? The first archaeologist that I know who has enjoyed this series, a little bit like Indiana Jones, is a bit of a guilty pleasure.
Yeah, we all enjoy it, really. Yeah, yeah. We don't like to admit it, but we do. Yeah.
But actually, what I really like about it, actually, is the fact that in this instance, one of the more recent things that we came across in the game, or that you come across, is actually a Marshalltown trowel. So there's a Marshalltown trowel that you have to, again, just clean off the dust from. Someone's engraved their name. I think it's like Martinez Vasquez or something has engraved his name on the handle. I just thought, this is nice. It's kind of, it's entertaining. It's quite good fun. The console itself feels quite nice to play with. But also, of all of the games in the series, this not only feels like a legitimate entry, it doesn't feel like a watered-down portable version, even though it is, it's not available on a home console, at least not yet. But also, it just has these little details that just remind you that actually Nathan is interested in the past, and he's not a formally trained archaeologist. He is essentially after treasure, but also at the same time he's been brought into this adventure because of his amassed knowledge and interest in this stuff. And so when you're doing things like charcoal rubbings and then maneuvering them to create the overall picture, you feel as though you're doing a bit of investigation. I found it very, very pleasant, and I figured as a little summer entry to a media pick, why not, you know? So there we have it, folks. Media pick of the month, or picks of the month. Your pick is quite accessible, being on iPlayer. Mine requires the purchase of a games console and a game, if you want to, but I would recommend the experience at the very least if you're interested. And I suppose just one final little thing that is a bit more accessible that I would recommend is the fact that I've been watching, I've been getting into sort of Japanese feudal history a little bit in the past couple of weeks. So I was playing Ghost of Tsushima. I was live streaming it last night, actually, and it's good. It's pretty good. It takes some liberties with the period. It's sort of 13th century, I think, 1237 or 1287, on Tsushima and the Mongol invasion.
Kamikaze and all that.
Yeah. So some aspects of the game are a bit anachronistic. Some of the weaponry is a bit later. Basically, it's a Kurosawa movie love letter set in a fairly respectfully rendered version of 13th century Japan. So I quite like it.
Nothing wrong with imitating Kurosawa. If it was good enough for George Lucas and Star Wars and the Hidden Fortress.
Well, actually, there's a character called Kenji in it who's basically an R2-D2 or a C-3PO kind of figure, which is quite cool. And there's even a Kurosawa mode, so you can actually, in the menu, you can make it black and white with film grain and play the game in glorious, because actually black and white films have a really high contrast and therefore often quite high definition. I mean, compared to some of the early colour films that you get, and especially in the 80s, black and white movies had that high contrast anyway. So actually playing a HD game in black and white doesn't feel anachronistic in that sense.
Just a brief diversion here, but it's why, you know, classic black and white movies, for example, a wonderful example is Alfred Hitchcock's version of Rebecca that was made, I think, in 1940. Mm. The lighting cameraman was James Wong Howe, one of the most famous Hollywood cameramen. Mm. And a film like that is shot on high quality film stock. Mm. And it's lit specifically for black and white. So when people try and colorize these things, it's why they end up being unsatisfactory. You know, it's not how it was meant to be shown. Mm. And it shows up when you try and, you know, force it into that tube of expectation of color. Yeah. It just doesn't work. You're right. It can be an incredibly powerful medium.
Mm. Absolutely. But I remember the colorization of It's a Wonderful Life being very controversial when that came about. Attendant to that, I've also been watching, I took the opportunity to watch Age of the Samurai on Netflix, a 5, maybe 6-part documentary, 43 minutes per episode, examining the rise of the Edo clan, I think, and I keep getting people muddled up. Was it Nobugara? Anyway, certain key.
I need to go and play Samurai Total Wars, whatever. I can't remember what it's called now.
The rise of certain key figures. I'm sort of nervous about mispronouncing. That's why I'm not going to go too much further along those lines. But ending with lots of. It's very reminiscent of, the story is very reminiscent of the tale of Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar, particularly actually Alexander, in so much as the legacy of one person led to various generals and lieutenants then fighting for supremacy, and then out of that comes a bit more stability. It's also actually sort of reminiscent of the transition in Rome from the Republic into the what we call the Empire or the Imperial. Period, in so much as you had a long period of civil war and strife, which was then ended by someone either being the last person standing or someone just having the authority just to shut it down, just to stop this fighting. It was good. It sort of filled in some blanks for me in terms of Japanese medieval history. And also, it's one of those, I don't know what's the equivalent for you, Andy, but for me, Japan and Egypt are two of those places that I kind of keep as little boxes of chocolates. I don't want to know too much about it because I don't want to be watching it with this hypercritical archaeologist's kind of, you know. It's really hard for me, to watch a Viking movie, you know, and just go, cool, because I'm going, no, that's nonsense, too early, wrong metal, you know, incorrect clothing, all this kind of thing.
So, but come on, we're a profession that criticised the dig for the wrong kind of trowels. So,
and the lemon drizzle cake.
And the lemon drizzle cake.
Absolutely.
So no, it's a serious matter.
It's a serious problem.
Yeah, actually, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, maybe it's. I came to feudal Japan through Kurosawa movies, which I absolutely love. Mm. They were one of the first sort of foreign language film. He was one of the first foreign language film directors I came across when I was, started to watch films seriously as a teenager and then at uni. And it's interesting how for a European, an alien, non-Judeo-Christian culture, it's almost like a palate cleanser.
Yeah.
In historical terms. Mm. Absolutely fascinating, wonderful, rich culture. Mm. I'd be with you on that. I don't know. I still love the aftermath of the Roman Empire, the fall of the Western Roman Empire, which has lots of affinities with that period. In Japan,
there's also an awful lot of interesting things that highlight the difference between a historian's approach and an archaeologist's approach. It's very much a TV series that's filled with historians telling you a story. So they're all kind of overlapping, lots of talking head type style documentary with dramatic scenes interspersed. But also I can't help, because being an archaeologist, I can't help but think, but what about the people, I think to myself, okay, it's fine that these people are warring, you know, this person doesn't like that person and they maneuver here and they outflank that person's position and so on and so forth, but I can't help but find myself just wondering, what was it like to live in a hut on the side of that hill? You know, what was it like to just be running a pub at the time, or to be trying to produce, for example, you know, artwork or music and this kind of thing. And some of that is slightly hinted at if it comes into the narrative of one of our main characters. It's a military history that's being presented in the series, and so in that sense. I guess that's where, actually, as you say, it's irresistible, isn't it? Archaeologists always again, but what about... We can't get away from it. But I would recommend it. It's worth watching. Definitely.
Good.
Grand. I hope that there's something in there for Media Picks this month that you guys might enjoy at home. We do intend to keep on doing Media Picks and Muppet of the Month as the months proceed.
I think before we end, we ought to just invite... first of all, as always, we invite people to join the discussion below the line. But I think particularly when it comes to Media Picks, with the plethora of channels and streaming services and some that are out there now, we can't take in everything. So if there's something out there that somebody's seen that they think we ought to be discussing and watching and recommending, or actually not recommending, recommending that you avoid like the proverbial plague, then again, join in the conversation below the line and we'll take a look.
Okay. Actually, this reminds me, I've got a copy of the film Year One, Jack Black's Year One, that someone has said I should watch I should watch with whiskey. So we're even open to that kind of suggestion.
You might say that about watching Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom or Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, but yeah, there we go.
Yeah. Drinking out of a crystal skull. Oh no, that's vodka, isn't it? That's Dan Aykroyd's vodka. Yeah. Anyway, thank you guys for watching. Until next time, do take care. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
This podcast episode has been produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network in collaboration with ArchaeoSoup Productions. Find out more podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.